Welcome to the Art School Podcast. I'm Ken Goshen. This is episode 3, and I have to say it's absolutely packed with valuable information for artists, so I suspect you'll really enjoy it. My guest today is Roni Yoffe. Roni is an Israeli painter, illustrator, and a teacher of painting and drawing. She's the founder and admin of the largest, most active, and fastest-growing Israeli art-related Facebook group. It's called Bet Sefer LeTziur, which means School of Painting. She runs multiple Instagram accounts devoted to art history and education, the links to which you can find in the show notes. Those of you who listened to the intro of episode 1 may remember a prediction I made. I said since I'm new to podcasting, I was bound to make a serious mistake at some point along the learning curve. Well, my friends, unfortunately, today is that day. When I was setting up to record this episode, I had my microphone settings all wrong, and as a result, the quality of my audio is suboptimal to say the least. Luckily, Roni sounds great, and she's the one sharing the vast majority of valuable information in this episode. To help you endure the discomforting sound of my voice, I recommend imagining that I'm an old radio broadcaster from the 50s and that I'm bringing you Roni's pearls of wisdom from the future. As always, if you enjoy this podcast, please rate it highly and subscribe wherever you're listening, especially on Apple Podcasts, as they weigh listener reviews very heavily. Every 5-star review helps this podcast reach more people, so thanks in advance. This podcast, as always, is brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. You can become a supporter too at patreon.com/Ken Goshen. And now I bring you my conversation with Roni Yoffe.
Roni, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's great.
It's a really pleasure to speak English again. I apologize for my accent.
No, I'm so glad to have some Israeli accent here on the podcast. It adds a level of Middle Eastern flair that I've been too late on incorporating into the mix. So I think the best thing to start off with is to let some people who don't know you yet know a little bit about yourself, your art background, your education, and what are you up to these days?
Art background. I've been studying drawing and painting professionally for the last 15 years in all kinds of programs. I had a mentor for 9 years, and then I went to the Tachana studio in Tel Aviv for 6 months, and there I met Eran Weber, and I studied with him for 2 years, and then he told me, Roni, come on, just go to Florence Academy. And then I spent only 1 year in Florence Academy. I could only afford 1 year, unfortunately, but it was really, really meaningful. And then I got back in 2018 and started studying painting to continue the program of Florence Academy with Stella Lamichov in Givatayim in Israel. And now for the last 6 months, I think, or at least a little less, I'm doing a little sculpture with Ron Weber.
Oh, no kidding.
It's really, really awesome. And during that time, I also did a graphic design course and a concept design course, little bit of this, little bit of that.
So you're all over the map. That's yeah, brilliant. Really. And so it's great to know that you and Eran are working together. He's one of my favorite people.
Awesome. I mean, his studio is like heaven.
I've only been there once, but it's like it's an absolute mind. Like that's really how you should construct your studio, with all the beautiful casts. And it's just, to people listening audio, they should probably check out, I guess it's eranweber.com, or like look for Eran Weber on Google. If you don't know his work yet, he's an Israeli sculptor, and both of us are basically drooling for pretty good reason. Once you take a quick look at his work, you'll see.
Every teacher in the Florence Academy, every time they ask me, I know your accent from somewhere. I said, yes, I'm from Israel. I said, oh, do you know Eran Weber? I said, yes, I'm his student. I'm like, Eran.
Yeah, I think he's the greatest ambassador of like Israelis worldwide in the realist community. So yeah, totally. I think where we can take this this conversation, I think what would make most sense to me is, I've known you for a few years, And for me, it's been a little bit of a journey to decide whether or not I should be focusing on social media. I should be doing things like that. I mean, at some point, I guess every artist goes through this conflict of, I want to be in the studio all day. I just want to be painting. I don't want to be dealing with all this other nonsense. But then you're forced to look reality in the face and understand the importance of social media for every artist's practice these days. And as I was just starting to get into it, I noticed how ahead of the curve you are, especially on Facebook. Okay. So do you want to maybe share with us your thoughts on art, social media, the intersection between them?
But I think very early, I started selling drawings and paintings on 2009. And it was, I think, at the summer of 2009, and I was in the end of some really, really weird project called 100 Bad Drawings. And I just posted every day a drawing I did the same day because I had no time. I had this regular job, like I was a pastry chef at a restaurant. I worked for 11 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I had zero time to draw. So I was getting up and in the first hour of the day, I drew something and I posted online, which eventually ended up to bring me many followers. It was really cool. And after 9 months at the restaurant, I saved a little money and I said, okay, I will leave the regular job and I will try to sell drawings. I have enough money. I saved for at least a year, I think. I had really a lot of savings. And then I said, okay, let's try. Let's give it a try. Many people are following me. They're reacting to what I do. Okay. And Facebook didn't have so many sophisticated algorithms. So people just saw what you did if they followed you. That simple. And then I said, okay, hey guys, I'm selling everything I do. So if anyone wants to buy something, it would be really cool. And two of my friends, they bought, I think, three paintings. They commissioned three paintings. For the living room, and I did it gladly. And another one from work, I think she bought something for her boyfriend. And it started off really, really, really slow and like very, very small amounts of money. I mean, they were my friends and I didn't know what's going on. And also I had zero idea what's going on in Israel or in the world in a matter of pricing. Had no idea. So I started off and I said, okay, it was August. And I said, okay, if until January I still have enough money, I will continue. If not, I will find a day job. And here we are.
Wow. That's a pretty stunning story. You tell it very casually, but I think for a lot of artists...
I tell it a lot of times.
Yeah. For a lot of artists, that's genuinely their dream. Like they literally get up in the morning and say, if I could only make money from selling my work and make that my primary occupation, I'd be satisfied. And
well, there are a few points, very, very important points that I say them casually, but I did post for every day for 3 months. Every single day I posted something and I didn't say I'm selling. I didn't say anything about marketing, about business, nothing. I just posted things and people started following me because they like what I did. And also I commented what they comment to me. And we had some sort of communication. And most people today, they think, oh, so I put like 10 works online right now. And I say for sale and magic will happen. Now I say it doesn't work this way, even especially today with all the algorithms, and it really depends on who your target audience. And when I ask some who your target audience, of course they say everyone. Because everyone should like my paintings. It's very, very not true. You should really know who your target audience. We can talk about it for at least 2 hours, but and also I saved money for a year of my life. Okay, if you want to go independent, you should calculate how much does it cost you to live, your rent, your food, your car, your friends, your addictions, your, I don't know, whatever. How much does it cost for 1 year and you save for that? Some people like to take risks, so they do it for 6 months. But I hate risks and I hate surprises, so I saved for 1 year. Okay, and it really gave me like security, you know, to just paint what I wanted to paint, not to take every commission, just commissions I was really interested in. I mean, some people wanted me to copy a Picasso. No, I some people want me to copy Jackson Pollock. No, I do not want to participate in that. So I could afford to refuse this. And every commission you post it online. I did this commission. It was very fun. And you just continue to do that. And during that time, along with Facebook, I also did, I don't know how to call it, I just posted things everywhere that was free. Like every forum, every website like DeviantArt, today we have ArtStation, every single place I could find that was free and I managed to operate. And then once you Google my name, you just have like 10 pages of Google. And it was really cool. I don't know if it still works like that today. I mostly post on Facebook and Instagram. I recently started TikTok, but
I like that.
Well, my audience is more of an educational thing.
That's brilliant. I love that look for the people who aren't watching the video. When Roni said TikTok, it's like that look that I guess us we're still considered millennials, but I guess we're the older millennials and. And
we're not millennials, we're boomers.
We're boomers, yeah. Well,
at least me. I'm not sure where you were born, but I think I'm very old for that.
88. Are you older than me?
85.
Oh my God.
I'm 85.
Well, you look young, my friend.
Yeah,
that's, but I do think both of us, I guess the word TikTok turns millennials into boomers. But I wanted to pick up on a few threads that you mentioned that I'm sure the listeners would love for you to delve deeper into. You said two really important things. One, you need to know what your target audience is, and I would love for you to say a few words about that, because initially, yeah. I mean, I know that I was there too when I was asked, well, what's your target audience? I would instinctively say, well, hopefully everyone, like I'm painting nice stuff. Why wouldn't everyone like my stuff, right? So how about you do a little corrective measure on my thinking? Why should only a few people like my stuff, or why should I care?
Well, first of all, you are a traditional painter. It means that you're not doing a mass production of a thing. You do a single thing every time, and you don't need to sell like 200 of the same thing. You need to sell only one painting, and only one buyer can buy one painting. So you don't really have to aim to everyone. I mean, I don't see why even. Also, I think pricing is a very good way to understand who in generally is your target audience. For example, if you have paintings that cost $500, are 18-year-olds can afford them? Are 15-year-olds can afford them? They're not your target audience, so you shouldn't post your work where they are the majority, hence TikTok, for example. And let's say your work, the minimum amount of money for something that you sell is $2,000. Now who your target audience is? Are people in college your target audience? I don't think so. Okay? So pricing is a really good way to start, like taking off groups of people that really are not relevant to you.
That's interesting. Now, I don't want to cut you off, but I was just going to say, when I said two things, the second was pricing. So I'm happy that you're ahead of the curve yet again.
I have what to say about pricing. Anyway, it's one way just to start thinking about your target audience. The second thing is the most important thing is, what are your paintings about? Okay, so if you do like what they call fan art, okay, if you paint the Joker and Wonder Woman and Spider-Man, so you need to think, who are the people who are most interested in those things? For example, my mother is not the target audience for these kind of paintings. It's for more young people. It's maybe for a geek community, which are very good audience. I love them. They really love spending money on really nice things. We love those. Okay. If you paint homage for computer games, also who are the people who are most interested in this. If you paint things that are about family and the babies and stuff like that, maybe moms are your target audience, right? And some people, you know, and in Israel, it's really common these days that you paint only still lifes. It's like the hottest. You can only sell still lifes, basically. You cannot sell landscape. You cannot sell nude. You cannot say portrait. I mean, only still lifes, just if you're a realist. So if you paint still lifes and you paint only pieces of raw meat, then all of the vegans are not your target audience, and we have many of those, okay? And it really depends on the subject matter, okay? You really need to know what are your paintings about, and I can't say that enough because it's also really good for art development. Like, why are you painting? Who are you painting to? What do you want to say in your painting, in your work, and who needs to hear it the most? So I think it's really, really important to really understand actually what are you doing. And I really used to hate that question because, like, why are you painting what you're painting? I said, because I like it. Well, it's nice when you're 20 to give that answer. But I think after a few years that you're working in this thing and you should have a certain idea. I mean, I imagine you have thought of it, like, why are you painting things? What is the common, like, what all your paintings have in common? And there usually is something in common, at least maybe 2-3 subjects, you investigate them separately. So you should have some sort of idea. And I think it's really helpful for you, to develop whatever it is that you're doing. Also to be very focused.
So do you have any kind of exercise that you propose to people if they're unfamiliar with how to answer that question and they think, well, I'm painting the stuff that I enjoy looking at and I don't know really how to find common themes. So if somebody really at stage one, what do they do?
First of all, you look at all of them together. It's really good just to spread them around the room or just look at your folder or whatever. Just look at them all together. And if you cannot find anything in common, just ask your friends. Okay, send a screenshot or a photograph of many paintings together. Ask them, send them to people for your family, to your friends, to your colleagues. And what do you see in common? What do these paintings have in common? And I'm pretty sure none of them will say, oh, there's nothing in common. I mean, there usually is something in common. Are they all figures? Are they all landscape? Are they all still lifes? Or maybe are they all related to where you were born? Are they all, I really like to paint ponds, like board games. I mean, so there must be something in common. So this is the first thing you should do is to look at your work from everything that you like, okay? Sometimes you have work that just doesn't represent you. It's okay. But just look at all the things that you like and try to understand, like, why did I do this? Why did I put so much time in painting the thing? Now, I also think that it's really common in Israel just to Google something and find a nice photograph and just copy it and represent it as your work. I used to do it, I think, until 2015. And if you copy someone else's composition, hence a photographer usually, then it's trickier to really figure out why did you paint it? You like it. But I mean, why? Why did you like it? So I really recommend if you want to go pro, if you want to go independent, start making your own composition. It's okay to draw or paint for a photograph. I'm sorry for everyone in Florence Academy for hearing this. It's okay to paint for photographs as long as you made it. You made the composition, you decided on the angle, on the lighting, on the subject, on the arrangement. If you decided everything, it's your own composition, and just work from this. If it's too difficult to work from life, it's okay. And when you are engaging in arranging your own composition, then you use your brain. I mean, you use your brain, and then you find reasons. Or reason, I like it in English. Reason is also like why, and also like it has some sort of sense. Okay. So start actually thinking about what you're doing and look at it, think of it.
That's really interesting. And I'd like to maybe add one point to that. When you're saying working from somebody else's photo or somebody else's reference, we have a lot of precedents for that in art history, where people weren't necessarily just copying the thing, but actually taking somebody else's work and creating some kind of adaptation to it. Like we would see it in Picasso's work and in Francis Bacon's work.
If you do homage, if you do a study, of course, it's super acceptable, of course. But if you do homage, it's even more important for you to understand what it is. Why is Las Meninas relevant to Picasso, to the Kernikaut or whatever? I mean, Maidens from Avignon, I'm not sure how to say it. I mean, if you do homage, then
everything's okay. Then you can think less and do more.
Think more. Like, why is this the homage? I mean, I see so many people just putting Starry Night and Girl with Pearl Earring together, and like, why would you do that? What is the why? I said, oh, it's nice. No, it's not nice. It's the only paintings you know.
Right. I mean, I also kind of, for me, this might be a little bit of a tangent here, but you mentioned the geek community. This always reminds me of like the fan art of putting characters from different TV shows together. It's like, what if Starry Night was connected to whatever Girl with a Pearl Earring? And it's kind of like a dreamscape that people just love, two giants, and they want to see them come together. So I kind of understand that. And the geek in me understands it.
No, I don't understand. I mean, why would you connect these two things? But there are so many works of art that you can connect and have some sort of new meaning. If you want to connect two pieces of art or three pieces of art, you should really know art. You should really like know the art history. I mean, to know only the celebrities and only the single paintings of the celebrities that are very famous, like Girl with Pearl Earring or Starry Night, then it will be thin,
right.
Thin idea. But if you connect something that, if you have like a lot of knowledge of art history, then you can think of many other paintings who would be better together.
Of course, right? And the reason that I was saying it is not because I endorse that strategy. It's just because I sympathize with the sentiment, but I think you hit on something extraordinarily important, and that's actually not discussed thoroughly enough, I think, in the, I would call it the beginner artist discourse, is the importance of an education in art history specifically. And there's a lot of acceptance about not really knowing where anything comes from. And it's a little bit different from other fields of creative output. Yeah. Like, for example, if I'm learning how to play the guitar, it would be crazy to think that I don't know who Jimi Hendrix is. It just would be crazy.
You couldn't
do it. If you're starting to learn piano and you're not familiar with Bach or Mozart, something is strange. But in art, I feel like there's a lot more room for art as quote therapy, close quote, I paint because it makes me feel good kind of thing. And that sometimes translates into a more serious hobby without ever having to go through that filter of making yourself more familiar with what came before you.
You know, what's their excuses? Their excuse is, I don't want to know anything that anyone did before me, so I don't copy. I want to be original.
And why is that wrong?
Rembrandt knew everything before him. It didn't bother him. It didn't disturb him to be original. I mean, all of the artists, all of the major artists, the most famous one, and not only the most famous one, they knew art history very, very good, and it didn't bother them. It didn't disturb them to be very original. So I think knowing art history, it really what helps you to be original. It really makes, it generates ideas, it generates connections between things. You understand what it means to interpret a situation, a history event, a biblical story. It's so important to study art history. And actually I'm doing this thing now recently. I think the last year I have five or six Instagram pages for art history in Hebrew, because we just don't have it.
We do not have.
You have whatever you studied in high school in like for your final exams, you forget it. And also, it's only the celebs, only Europe, only of course male artists. And this is art history for you. Maybe you did a master's degree or something like that, and you know a bit more, but it's very narrowed. And also, you have no idea what's going on today.
So do you want to plug those accounts to the people who are interested in art history and Hebrew, just to make sure that they follow the correct accounts?
Do I send them to you?
We'll put them in the show notes. You'll send them to me. I'll put them in the show notes. So, and to the people who would want to go, I know this might be too broad of a question, but to the people who are encouraged by what you're saying and they want to go deeper than following a few Instagram accounts, do you have any kind of resource that you find to be extremely valuable for art historical education? Where would you point people?
Well, if it's online, then I will give you another link for a very basic and really nice and short course for art history. It's called From Rembrandt to Goya or something like that. It's a series of lessons, 7 minutes or 10 minutes. It's a really nice starting point. And what I recommend is just find someone that is you're interested in or you like their work and start with Wikipedia. Seriously, just start with Wikipedia, read about them. In the Wikipedia, you have names of their teachers, of their schools, of their colleagues, of their paintings. And you could just start searching your own things that are interesting for you. Also, the second thing I really, really recommend to do, it's a little bit technical, arrange a timeline. Because I had no idea when was the 16th century. I had no idea when Michelangelo lived. I had no idea when Velázquez lived. I had to draw a timeline and just place everyone in the right place to understand when everything happened. And then I realized that between Donatello and all the other Ninja Turtles, there were so many years they didn't know each other. And if you watched Hannah Gadsby's show Douglas, you also know why Titian is not Ninja Turtle. And if you don't know, I will not spoil it for you.
No, I have to know. You have to tell me. Oh my God. Okay, so do we have to go watch it? Okay.
It's an amazing show. It's really, really funny. And she really gives a really good explanation why Titian is not Ninja Turtle. And it's the truth.
I'm going to venture a guess. Everybody can know that I have not yet watched the aforementioned episode, but isn't it because he wasn't from Florence or didn't spend any time in Florence? No? She's okay. To the audio listeners, I'm getting a no from Ronnie here. I'm getting a clear no. Okay, well, my theory was all of them are Florentines or at least made most of their work in Florence, but okay, I have some catching up to do. So to people who are looking for more sources on art history, I would say the best place to start is a book by Gombrich called The Story of Art. It's a bit of a heavy book, but it's also a heavy lift. To say I'm going to tell you the whole story of art in a book, we're lucky that it's not twice the length. And I think it's a fantastic resource.
I really like to recommend things that I can handle. So, I mean, there are books. I mean, in the your previous video with Steven Bauman, he mentioned the Harold Speed, the Practice in Science of Drawing. I also really recommend this book, but I know it's not for everyone, especially if they're not English speakers, 18th century English speakers. And so I also recommend I think Google Art Project in YouTube. They have also, it's a series of short videos about a single painting. And it's really, really interesting and fun to watch. And also the channel of National Gallery in London. Mm. They are amazing. I just want to visit there and spend all my life in the National Gallery because of their videos. And also it's short. There are short videos, sometimes not very short, sometimes an hour and a half even. But they really, really give you also some information about a specific painting or specific artist. And it's a starting point. It's really, really good.
I want to pull us back to something that I told myself not to forget before I get carried away into the art history dimension, which has a great pull on me. Cool. Give us a word or two about pricing, if I don't know what to do, I'm looking at my work and you say, okay, target audience, I need to understand who's willing to pay for my work. And then I need to know how much my work is worth. Well, how do I make that determination?
Okay. Well, there are a few ways. First way that I really like is you spy. You spy on your colleagues. Okay. For example, I follow all kinds of artists that I admire and look up to. And recently, one of them posted paintings and she said, these are for sale. And she wrote the price. And I said, oh, that's really important information. She sells a drawing, an A3 drawing, for $250 as a starting price, not include shipping. It gives me a really good idea of how much this quality of drawing worth for her. And I am assuming she works with the galleries, she knows her business and everything. I mean, I follow people that are professional to me. So if just spy on your colleagues.
That's pretty good.
I mean, just go and look for the auction, go for the gallery, go to everything in place that they represent the work for sale and just look at the prices. It's really, really interesting. I did this in a specific show in Israel. They had a catalog and I snuck into the back and I found the catalog and I saw that this kind of painting has the price of $25,000. It was mind-blowing. I said, oh, I can raise my price a little bit. Why not? A little bit. It gives a really, really good idea for what's going on around you. And I really recommend go to openings of galleries, talk to artists, be friends with artists, and you can ask them like how to price things. Another way is just if you haven't sold anything, you don't know anyone, you're just really, really a green noob, right? So you just look at the thing and you try to figure out like who would want that? Who would be happy to have it? And then you imagine a person, maybe they're like you. How much could you pay for this thing? And you start, you gamble, you just gamble. You throw a price, you post it online. Maybe someone will buy it. Maybe someone will buy it. And then someone else just write in the comment, oh, I want it and I'm willing to pay more. Maybe you have a little auction, like a spontaneous auction. Okay, just you gamble, you start and you gamble. What I really, really don't recommend is start off really, really low because it's very difficult to raise your bar. So think, if you are getting paid like a babysitter or like a cleaning person or like, a taxi driver, does this suit your profession? And some people will say it is because they're very insecure. But when you are selling paintings or drawings, especially paintings, it's you're selling an artwork. It's something that is unique. It's one of a kind. No one else has it. It makes zero sense to have the same price or the same salary or hourly rate as a babysitter. Okay? And think of other professions. How much does your shrink get for 1 hour of work? I think it's reasonable at the start to compare your rate to theirs. I think
so.
Okay? As a shrink,
I'm assuming that there's another issue here that you're touching on. Should we be measuring how long it takes us to finish a piece?
Should, because it's interesting, I think. And if you want to do commissions, then you should be able to estimate like how long. Does it take you to finish a painting? Like generally, you don't tell the client, I will finish this in 23 hours. I mean, you don't say it. And you also like exaggerate, okay, by the end of this month, I'm assuming it will be finished. Okay. So I think you should know how much time does it take you to do something. And I also think that you shouldn't offer commissions that you don't know how to do yet. I mean, I offer portraits from photographs. I go to the client and we take a really nice photo that suits a painting, okay? And then I know how much that it takes me to work from a photograph, okay? Because I did it so many times. I will not offer a commission for a mural, OK? okay, or like something really gigantic or something from imagination, I wouldn't offer this as a commission because I haven't done this. If I know there is an audience and that I'm interested in, I will do several paintings like this for myself or for a family member or something who really, really loves me. Okay, and I did this for them, this piece for, I don't know, something a symbolic rate or a barter or just for favor, I don't know, whatever, a present, whatever. I will have several works that, and then I will know how much does it takes, what does it requires, and then I can offer this as a commission, as a thing that I'm doing. And it's really important because people just, I have an iPad, I'm doing commissions. It's really, you really shouldn't do it. People just, they're consulting me. Oh, I did this thing for a client that they already paid me, and it's not really good. It's not really, it doesn't look like the person. What should I do? I say, okay, is it your first time? Kind of. Yeah, that's the problem.
Just yeah, don't offer this is, I feel like there's basically these two poles that we can see people on. One of them is too eager to already start the work without having the skills, and on the other end we have somebody with the skills but maybe that doesn't even know how to actually approach starting a project,
and solid confidence.
I think you said something interesting there about the spontaneous auction that's happening that leads us kind of back to social media, and I remember that you were saying something else, quote, before the algorithm changed, something like that, you know. So maybe, I mean, just I'm just going to lay out how it feels like to me to be on Facebook these days, and maybe you can perform a correction on my brain and how I'm treating
that. I'm watching you. You're doing a pretty good job on Instagram.
Instagram fluent. I'm very fluent on Instagram. Instagram makes perfect sense to me. And I've spent a lot of time exploring how that algorithm does. And it's a process of, there was a lot of research. Like I would post something, I'd see the engagement, I'd geek out over the analytics, I'd kind of understand. The thing that people don't understand about Instagram, I'm just going to keep it brief because I don't want to ramble about Instagram because I actually want to know what you have to say about Facebook. But on Instagram, what you have to understand is that it's not only if you're posting something and the post isn't getting traction, the automatic response that everybody has is, oh, maybe people aren't appreciating it. But the higher level, I see that you're laughing. The higher level there is to understand maybe you've done something to offend the robots. There's an algorithm behind here, and the algorithm has their own agenda. The algorithm wants to do with your work things that you don't necessarily care about, but the algorithm cares about. So when something doesn't work, it doesn't mean your drawing is bad. It doesn't mean your painting is bad. Yeah. It just means it didn't hit that mark that Instagram is really looking for. So I'm sure something like that is happening on Facebook too. But my experience on Facebook is whenever I open it, I just see the same post from 3 days ago that I've already seen, that I may have already commented on. I know I have almost 5,000 friends, and yet I'm only seeing posts from maybe 50. And so if I put some spontaneous auction out there, and I'm telling you, despite the fact that, you know, it doesn't even matter if my painting is going to be attractive. I know that on Facebook, I'm doing something wrong. So what should I be, what should I be doing?
Well, you said whenever I open Facebook, right?
I did say that.
Every few days?
No, much more frequently.
Every day?
On Facebook? Okay. Definitely.
Okay, on Facebook, from what I understand, and it's really, I think it's kind of unique because most people use Facebook now. If they want to sell, they do sponsored ads. And I don't still, and pretty proud of it. But I engage all the time. I mean, I comment to other people. I like things from other people. And also I have the Facebook group, which I'm really, 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 really active in that group. And it makes people see me more because I'm so active everywhere on Facebook. Everywhere I am, I'm active. By the way, for seeing the same post, every person I confirm to my friends, like my friends list, I do unfollow because I cannot stand politics and all kinds of dogs and babies and everything. So I follow, I think, only maybe 10 of my friends. And all of the rest is just art groups, art pages, and stuff like that. So when I open Facebook, I just see artworks. Also about education, it's very, very important just to feed your brain with artworks all the time, and my group. But I still, I do so much engaging on Facebook, and it just, it gives me more exposure. And also I have like 5,000 friends and like 2,000 followers, and they're kind of my target audience. I mean, they know what to expect, and I keep surprising them. Also, I don't only post things about selling paintings. And it's also really, really important if you're selling through your a personal profile. Also through a page, but this I don't know much about pages. So
why is it important?
Because... Well, okay, again, what's the question? What's important?
You said that it was important to not only post about selling art. Maybe explain to people for whom it's not obvious.
Because people want to know the person behind the thing. It also happens in your show, like in the gallery. People want to meet you. They want to ask you questions. They want to know what you think about things. And they really want to know what you think about their stuff. And people just want to know what's going on. And I really enjoy Facebook, which is a really, really important point about marketing in Facebook. If you don't enjoy the Facebook, it will not work for you.
Does it know I'm suffering? Hard. It knows it about me, huh? How does it know?
The algorithm knows that you are not enjoying yourself. Now, I enjoy Facebook because I post all kinds of things. If I, for example, I did this really, really big painting about variety in Israeli society, and I wanted to represent that with all of the spices I can think of that are in Israeli food, which is basically all of the spices ever. So I asked in my Facebook, hey, what is the main spices you use in your kitchen? Now, this post, it gives me information that helps me just to brainstorm about my work. And people know that I'm sneaky, that I'm doing something with this information. But also it's a question that everyone can answer. And everyone enjoys reading the other answers, and they are engaging in my post, and I engage, and it makes this, whoa, everybody's here, and something interesting is happening in this girl's page, okay? And sometimes I ask about biblical stories, and I ask about problems with my computer, and all of these things just brings more people that weren't engaging in the previous post, they're now engaging. Okay, so I don't only post about one thing. I post about many things that are interesting to me. I don't fake it. I don't just put posts just to put them. Okay, I once asked, can tell difference between parsley and coriander? I put these two silhouettes of these two leaves because I was interested in how many people can figure out the difference. It was just 200 comments.
Wow.
And it bring really a lot of engagement to my personal profile. And people are thinking, oh, she's funny. I like her post. She's funny. Okay. And they come because I'm funny because oh, and also, ooh, now I have a baby.
So be funny and get babies is the notes. Yes. I took. But
a pet is also good, but not as a baby.
So yes. I wanna maybe this is gonna sound conspiratorial to you, but I do recall that maybe if I look 3 years back, I was relatively active on Facebook and also enjoying it more and also seeing more of the people that I'm friends with, even though I don't know them in real life. Like I would just follow and befriend some artists on Europe or whatever. And then in a almost like one day arrived, and then my posts that used to get a lot of engagement just suddenly stopped. I started only seeing the people that I am, you know, that they know in real life. I feel like the robots have gotten smarter and they know who I actually know.
They did this change in the algorithm where people you not engage with for a certain amount of time, then you stop seeing their post. It's also a reason, I mean, if you want to market your things on Facebook, it's also a reason to like things of all kinds of people and send messages every once in a while. For example, in the group, I try to be smart with the algorithm, and I say, okay, this is the post. I write some things. And if you want to know, if you want to get the link to the thing that I'm talking about, just write in the comment, give me a link. So also it's in makes engagement. And also I have a reason to send a private message to the person. And so they see me more because I send them a private message. So it's kind of sneaky, and I don't spam. I promise I don't spam anyone, but you just have to flow with it because to flow with it. Yeah. It's Hebrew now. Yeah, you need to go with the flow of Facebook because it's changing all the time, and it just gets more difficult for small businesses or artists because they just want you to pay them money. Okay, I mean, I know all these artists, portrait art, I don't like calling them artists, but they make portraits on commissions, and they do these sponsored ads, and I'm guessing that because I see the sponsored ad, maybe it works for them. So if you want to sell things through Facebook easily, I think, then just go for the sponsor's ad. I mean, I know a person that pays 10,000 shekels per month for posting on Facebook, and wow, and he sells his work. He has his own gallery, and he has a reputation, and everybody copies him, and because it's very easy. And
I think the two of us and probably the people listening are almost more interested, not almost, certainly more interested in the organic hackery, because I don't think any one of us is keen on dropping 10,000 shekels on Facebook ads. But I wanna circle to something that you've mentioned twice already, and I'm of course very interested in talking about it. The aforementioned group, the group. So Ronnie runs, I guess, the biggest Israeli art community on Facebook. And I think by
not
far,
only the biggest is the most active from, I mean, I we now have 42K, and we have over 30,000 people active. Now Facebook gives me all the analytics, 30,000 people active in this group, and I'm really, really proud of it. In February, we will have 10 years, and it's really, really awesome.
Birthday.
And it's really, and it's really, it's actually an arts community I built because I just wanted people to talk to. It started in 2012 or 11, I think, if we do the math.
Oh, goodness. Anyway, so we were together in a tachana back then.
No, we're together at Hana.
Oh, no, you came after me and I was coming to visit. Yeah. I see.
Anyways, I was in these all kinds of forums, Hebrew forums about art, and most of them were for children. And I was the admin of a specific forum. And then I had this supervisor who was a 16-year-old girl. And we got this in this argument. And in the end of the argument, she just kicked me out of being the admin of this forum. And I said, really? I'm going to destroy a forum. And I just opened a Facebook group, call it Bet Sefer Tziur, which means drawing school or painting and drawing school, because Tziur is the same, is both in Hebrew.
No, it's Rishum. I stand by Rishum. Never mind.
No, of course, but Tziur is painting. Okay, school of painting. Okay. Fine. And I invited a few of my friends, and it just grew and grew and grew. And then I think after 2 years, work 1,000 maybe. And then I had this interview in Channel 2 on television in 10 a.m. in the morning, like only old people watches television then. And I talked about this group. It was 10 minutes interview. And in that day, I got, I think, 2,000 people added to this group. It was insane. And then, speaking of Facebook algorithm, on May, it was my brother's wedding. So I remember the 1st of May, 2000. And okay, I don't really remember the year, but we were, I think when I passed the limit of 3,000 people in the group, I had over 100 applications for the group in a day.
Wow.
And something changed on Facebook algorithm. I don't know, after you pass through a limit, it started suggesting your group to so many people, and it just grew and blew up. And we got to 10,000 people, I think, through maybe 2 months, from 3,000 to 10,000. And it just, now I think I have, I'm adding, I started screening people. I have this question, if you want to enter, and I only approve people who answer the questions. So I have over 50 people, maybe 60 people a week.
Wow.
So it's, yeah, it's, I'm really proud of it. It's really awesome. And I opened a Patreon page for the group. It's also only Hebrew, so put the link, but I don't know who will join. A Patreon page. I have a YouTube page with all kinds of tutorials and explanations, and I think over 200 videos already. The Instagram pages, the TikTok, and anyways, I really want people in Israel to know more about art, and I have more people to talk to.
So if we drill down on this, you start a Facebook group because of two reasons. You want to talk to people and you want revenge.
Yes, and I want revenge.
And
I got it.
And you love it. But then it starts picking up and you have more people than you can possibly talk to. And this thing explodes and becomes huge. So now it looks to me like you have kind of future ambitions. So where do you think this group, I mean, even if you started it, you know, just thinking let's do a cool thing and talk about art, but now that it's this behemoth, where do you want to steer this ship now that you're captain of something big?
The major point in opening the Patreon, it was my Patreon during my year in Florence Academy. It was kind of my blog. And then when I got back here, and actually after the baby was born, I get so creative, crazy creative. I get so many ideas. And this was one of them. Just make your Patreon the group's Patreon. Because I thought, okay, I have 42,000 people in this group. If half of them gives me $1 per month, I can open a school. I can give scholarships. I can give prizes like Shif, okay, like Shif prize or Keshet prize or all kinds of prizes we have in Israel, like an artist prize. I can have exhibitions. I can buy art from local artists that you don't know. I can have my own gallery with my own taste and just put there everything I see in value. And I also can just create courses. I can pay artists I appreciate, and they come and they teach for a really low rate. I mean, whoever comes to participate in a workshop and a course can pay really low money because the professor are already paid. So, and also I can buy art from local artists for whatever price they want. I mean, I don't need to bargain. I don't need to have discounts. I don't need to lower the price to make them feel like they owe me something. I can actually whatever price is saying, I can afford it because I have this 42,000 group. And that's mainly the idea. And I really want to make all of this happen. And it's going really slow also because COVID, of course, but Israeli audience are not really familiar with Patreon yet. So step by step.
Yeah, step by step. Listen, all these ambitions sound not only great, they sound, I mean, I really relate to that. I mean, having a Patreon of my own and you know, also having the ambitions to one day open a school and all that stuff sounds fantastic. So, you know, I'm rooting for you and I'm hoping that all of that comes.
No, I'm looking at you. You are a part of this. I mean,
I'm trying. You know, we're in these circles. You know, we're working it out. We're making it happen because I think both you and me, maybe with slightly different approaches as a response to it, kind of grew up in Israel in with a feeling of something is missing here artistically. You know, people.
There is nothing here. Eran Weber once told me that whoever grew up in Israel and has some sort of aesthetic sense is so lucky. it's so unlikely to grow up in Israel and just and have an aesthetic sense, because nothing.
So let me just bring our audience in. So to those of you who are not Israeli and don't really understand what Roni and I are talking about, Israel is an extraordinary, and correct me, Roni, if you disagree, Israel is a very pragmatic place. Like when you go to study medicine, it makes sense to people. You go to study law, it makes sense to people. If you're developing whatever, mechanical engineering.
Music or theater or literature, you have some place to study and it makes sense.
Yeah, but when you try to study art, people ask you, okay, that's your hobby, but what are you going to do
with it?
What is that? Like, it doesn't even register to people as a profession, which makes the environment, you know, very difficult to navigate. And I mean, my response to it, and I'm not saying that this is as a permanent fixture of my being, but I left. So I've been out of Israel for about 9 years, but the stated goal was to establish all the stuff that I need to establish in order to, you know, hold my head up high. And then one day come back with all those resources and do something similar to what you're doing, trying to cultivate this environment so that the other generation, like the next generation, won't have to live under the same conditions.
It will happen in our generation. Come on. I mean, ever since I went to the Florence Academy and just posted every day something I did there in the group, people are starting to be interested in going to school outside of Israel. And it's really new. It's really awesome. And also in the last, I think, 15 years, I think in United States alone, they over 100 ateliers just emerged. Mm. So there are many, many places that you can go and get education outside of Israel, and people are doing it. And now I know this one girl in Grand Central Academy, and there is another few in Florence Academy in Florence, and another one or two, I think, in the Barcelona Academy. And they are coming back. They're coming back to Israel and they start working and they start painting, they start doing commissions, they start showing their work. And people are also interested more and more in figurative and realistic painting. Also due to, we owe a lot to Israel Hirschberg and Aaron Gershoni and David Nippo and Schiff Prize. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think last year, 2 years ago, it was 10 years for Schiff Prize, and it was a huge exhibition on Tel Aviv Museum. And the audience was there were so many visitors, and it was so irregular for the museum. And also to exposure in the internet, people are more interested in figurative art, in realistic art, in hyper-realistic art, whatever, photorealistic art. And it's come from everywhere. Tattoo artists are interested in this, and graphic designers are interested, and concept artists are interested. And everyone needs this kind of knowledge and skill. So whoever can, they go outside of Israel or they study online in platforms like Schoolism and Udemy or something like that. So it's getting better.
So just to tell the story to the people who are not in on it. So when Roni says that we owe a lot to Israel Hirschberg, I think we can safely say that he's one of the most influential classical art teachers that Israel has ever known. He studied in the United States, I think in Brooklyn with Leonard Anderson. I'm not totally sure, but wherever he studied abroad, he brought all this knowledge back. And then he raised two generations of just heavy hitter painters. two of whom are Aram Gershuni and David Nippo, which Roni mentioned. And with both of them, we studied with both of them. And so we could be like the third generation to the Hirschbergian revolution.
No. I only been to the Tachana for 6 months and basically I ran away because I did not felt home. I did not understand anything. And it was really, really weird experience. But I think as generally figurative painters or realistic painters, we owe them so much because they opened the door to Israeli audience to really know these kind of paintings. I mean, I don't really like the works of Aram Gershuni. Okay, I don't really appreciate him, but he opened the door. It's so, so important. And I think clearly it's due to his father, to his wife, to his mother. They're all like an artistic family. They have these events and they are the celebrities of the art world in Israel. And I think we owe them a lot. Everyone who is ever doing figurative or realistic paintings. And also we are very much influenced by them because this is the reason that people are only buying still lives in Israel is Aaron Gershuni and David Nippo and Israel Hirschberg. I mean, to call them figurative are kind of weird because they're not doing anything with the figure. Maybe every once or twice, but I mean, mostly still lives and landscapes. So it's really like a thing, like an Israel, what is Israeli art? What is Israeli realistic art is usually still life's centered composition, a single thing or two things, light from one of the sides, usually northern light because it's so beautiful. And usually it's not gigantic. I mean, the thing that I have behind me is like the opposite of Israeli painting. Like they do all these things. Like it's not modest. It's like it's.
What's the Hebrew word?
Sanua.
Yeah, modest works.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, they paint a glass of water and a loaf of bread, a pot of milk, an orange, right? It's so serious. It's full of ethos.
Yeah, it's also I think that you're touching on such an interesting point. I just have to make sure that to everybody who's not Israeli, I'm kind of bringing them into this narrative because I'd love to continue pursuing that point. But I think Ronnie is describing a state of Israeli realistic art in a very accurate way. There's a whole style around it. It's very somber, very quiet, very reflective. Yes. It's not at all celebratory. It's not like how would you say it? It's not extravagant. It's not luxurious. It's very like matter of fact, dry and purposefully so. Yeah, which is to the people who can't see the video. So Ronnie is pointing to a huge composition behind her of a lady around a ton of fruits. She's half reclining. There's a lot of fruits. There's a landscape with a sunset in the background. So a lot of celebration and color and
actually one time I painted this thing and it was on 2015, I think, when I was still in the Tachana. And I didn't want to admit it, but I was so influenced by Aram and Nippo and Aram Gershuni and David Nippo. And I painted this composition. I called it Candy Kingdom. It was just so many candies, candy, candy, candy. It was super colorful. And I put it on a flat background, like a wall, like a dry wall with all the cracks and everything. And on a wooden table. And I showed it to Aram. And he told me, you make it a joke about Aram Gershuni. I said, yes. Yes, I'm doing it. Brilliant. Yes, it's so funny. It's so funny. Paint something funny in a serious way. I really totally relate.
And I love humor and art. But I also want to make sure that our listeners understand one more thing about realistic art. Unlike in New York, for example, if I'm confused about art and I want to ask myself, well, what is this thing called art? You know, I have this enormous institution called the Met. I go to the Met. Yeah. And then I see everything from the somber paintings of Caravaggio to the extreme celebration of the Rococo, which I hate. But we get a very wide range. Within a 4-hour trip to the museum, I can see all the possibilities that art history has basically devised over the years. But in Israeli art, if you want to go see figurative painting, you kind of can't unless you do look at the works of those living masters. We have very few.
We have two museums that has something to offer. Tel Aviv Museum of Art has a very small collection. It's not a small collection, actually. I've been to the Safe. They have a huge collection, but they show only a small part of it. And it's like two rooms. And you can see, like, I think maybe 30 or 40 paintings. But we have a Rubens, they have a Van Dyck, they have a Rembrandt. And it's okay, but really not. You cannot compare this museum to any other museum. By the way, this museum is huge and it's pretty much empty.
Yeah.
But I visited the safe and they have so many things. I have no idea what they, I mean, I do. They explain it to me, but they don't show all they have. Also, they have Israel Museum in Jerusalem, which is a fine museum. It's fine mostly for archaeological and cultural things like Judaism and Islam. But they have a fine art collection and it's fine.
It's fine, but that's the main reason that I feel like if you had to really question me, that's why I feel like I left. Because for me, I wanted to be completely immersed in this thing that I found to be, you know, lacking.
Yeah.
For me, it felt like I wanted to be a professional swimmer in a country with no pools. You know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Yeah. And so I think to give credit to the living master, to the Israeli living masters, it makes sense that their influence is so overwhelming because they're the only thing around. They're the only thing around. If you want to learn how to paint figuratively and you want to look those paintings in the face, that's kind of what you're looking at. You know, these are the influences that are on offer. And it's very interesting. And I think it does account for how different Israeli art is from even Israeli figurative art.
Yeah, no, actually, I've been thinking about it a lot. And I also talked about it with, I opened this group to have people to talk to. So, I mean, what is Israeli art? And we had this really iconic exhibition in the 80s that called Poverty of Matter. As a quality in Israeli art, the whole name.
Yeah, maybe say it in Hebrew so that we understand.
Okay, it's Dalut HaChomer Ke'eichut Be'omanut HaYisraelit.
So this would mean the poverty of means or the poverty of materials as a quality in the art of Israel, right?
Yes. This exhibition basically showed trash and garbage. I mean, this is what they did in the 80s, everyone. Trash and garbage and all kinds of weird things, like very, very postmodern conceptual things. Ugly, dirty, and really from things like old paper, newspapers and condoms and paper bags and nylon bags, all kinds of things. And I really think it set the tone for what is Israeli art, because it also connects with the culture up till then. Israel was founded in 1948, and it's a very bad time for figurative art, for realistic art, for academic art. It's a very bad time. And also people came here from Europe and they just didn't want anything to do with Europe culture. So they really reject everything that's resembled Europe culture, old culture, and they wanted to make something new. And it was all like they fit in with all the postmodern movement, Dada and whatever, post-expressionism, all kinds of things. And they formed this kind of cliques, like a small group of people, usually white men that has some money and power and education, and they call themselves artists, and they set the tone here for what is Israeli art and what is art in general. And it got into the academies and into all the galleries and all the institutions and all the teachers. And then I think in 1992, Israel Hirschberg came to Avni College. And they let him teach a drawing class, and he saw the painting teacher and said, "What? What is this? What? Fuck this shit! I'm going to make my own school." And he did. And then we started off with one teacher, with one atelier, and from there they came out. Aram Gershuni, maybe. Actually, Aram Gershuni really doesn't say he was a student of Israel Hirschberg, but we all kind of agree he was, okay. And David Nipo and Ran Reshef and Erez Aharon and all kind of people, and Sigal Tzabar, which I really like. And then we really started with a small group of people, and no one was a celebrity then. No one knew them, and the essence of the poverty of matter. It's now it's still in their art. Like everything is like only really, really simple things. We paint simple things and we don't use any narratives. It's a potato. I don't talk about anything. It's just a potato. I see light, interested in light, and I don't want to be resembled to anything too gigantic or mythological, God forbid, biblical. Oh no, they're all really, really non-religious, like very atheist. I think it's atheist paintings. Everyone who tries to paint something biblical is just, oh, you're religious. No, it's propaganda. Yeah. So it's really hard. And also we have this thing in Judaism, which is the rule from the Bible. You should not make a sculpture or image or something like that. It has many interpretations, but basically we don't represent the figure. We don't do it. It's not acceptable really in Israel, in Hebrew culture, in Judaism culture. Although we have some Jewish painters from 19th century, it was very figurative and amazing. But in Israel culture, it's really, I mean, if you have a nude figure, then, oh, wait, so we have to present it in behind closed doors and many people won't like it. And what does it mean? And if you see a naked figure, then who is she? Who is she? I have to know. People don't, it doesn't occur to people that she might represent an idea. No, who is she?
Yeah, it's everything is very matter of fact. But I think from this tradition, some people's work, you know, they are springing from that tradition and actually kind of flipping it over on its head. Three names come to mind who were also in all of these educational establishments that you list. I think people like Amir Shepet, people like Ilya Gefter, people like Ran Tenenbaum. These are people who are really taking this Torah, you know, that we got from Israel Hirschberg and seeing how that can be subverted. Are there any more names or do you disagree with me?
Ran Tenenbaum and Ilya Gefter, I still see, I mean, Ilya Gefter, I follow him and I see mostly like the subject matter is really like life. Like, okay, this is a part of Tel Aviv. This is a part of the beach. I don't really sense a sort of narrative that I can relate to anything, but okay, this is where I am. This is what I live. This is my world. Okay.
But what about the colors? The colors are definitely out there. You know, he stresses color way more than would have been, quote, you know, acceptable. I don't know. In
yeah, of course. I mean, I know that there is this kind of style, like you see, oh, this guy is a student of Israel Hirschberg because the palette is all gray. And one time I drove with a friend and it was so mist and rain. He said, oh, everything looks like Israel Hirschberg student's work. And every time you see something with bright colors or with the high chrome, it's like, ah, shit. And there's also Ferber.
Ferber.
Yeah. I mean, his landscapes are also, you see, he came from the JSS school, the Israel Hirschberg school, but, oh, wait, high chrome. And in Israel, everything is high chrome. In Israel, everything, you go out your house, everything. The light is high chrome, the colors, the voices, the flavors, the music, the people, the religion, everything is high chrome, high pitched, high contrast, everything. So painting everything like mellow and quiet.
Wow, that's beautiful. I love that theory, but I really like that because it actually suggests painting as an escape from the extremely high pitched, high chroma reality experience of Israeli life. I think you have a thesis there that's worth writing about, you know, how a country
in the Patreon.
See, there we go. So a country with everything being so loud is actually kind of enchanted with quiet, modest painting. Ronnie, I think this would be a great time to tell people where they can find you.
Everywhere. Just Google my name and I'm everywhere, mostly on Facebook. Okay, Ronnie Yoffe, just write my name, Ronnie Yoffe, and also on Instagram, also on TikTok, and the same name all over. And that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm in all kinds of, again, forums and galleries online, but mostly social media, not Twitter. I mean, I have a Twitter and it connects with my Facebook, but I never go go on Twitter.
So everybody should Google Rani Yoffe, as I will spell it properly in the title of this episode. And no need to follow her on Twitter because she's not going to write much there. But make sure that you
It's synchronized with my Facebook. So, I mean, it's all Hebrew. Oh, actually, my Instagram is English. So if anyone wants to follow me, Instagram is really the best way. Mostly stories because I'm working on really huge projects now and I don't really update for of personal work. But my stories, I show like the progress on this and I have another painting of my father and I have this commission. So mostly Instagram, actually, for English speakers.
Brilliant, Rani. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Sure, it was fun.
Thank you for joining me. If you enjoy this podcast and would like to see it grow, please take a moment to subscribe, rate it highly, and share it with a friend. If you'd like to become a supporter of the show and have access to exclusive content, please consider signing up as a patron at patreon.com/KenGoshen. For online lessons, please visit kengoshen.com/lessons. Thanks again, and see you next time.